Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
Thank you for joining the Empowerment Zone. I am your host, Ramona Houston.
History, history, history. I am absolutely thrilled that I have my first interview with a fellow historian on the Empowerment Zone this morning. Our guest today is Dr. Cynthia E. Orozco, and she's going to tell us all about her new book, Agent of Change, Adelis Los Pinto, Mexican-American Civil Rights Activist and Texas Feminist. Hi, Cynthia. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. Good morning. And thank you for having me, Ramona. Dr. Houston, it's nice to be here.
Well, I am so delighted to have you. Dr. Orozco is of Fuero, Texas. She's a Tejana like me. And she's daughter of Mexican immigrants, and she is a historian, author, and film and museum consultant. A two-time Ford Fellow, Dr. Orozco is professor of history and humanities at Eastern New Mexico University. Ruidoso?
Yes.
Dr. Orozco earned degrees from the University of Texas at Austin, also my fellow alumna, right? And the University of California at Los Angeles. She is author of No Mexicans, Women or Dogs Allowed, The Rise of the Mexican-American Civil Rights Movement, which is a UT Press best-selling academic book between 2010 and 2020. And she's also the author of a forthcoming book entitled Pioneer of Mexican-American Civil Rights, Alonzo S. Perales, which I can't wait to read. She wrote 80 encyclopedia articles for the Handbook of Texas and over 100 articles and letters for newspapers in Texas, California, and New Mexico. She was board member of Unladylike 2020, celebrating women of the progressive era and commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the women's suffrage, which appeared on PBS earlier this year. Dr. Orozco has also served as a campaign manager of the Leo Martinez congressional race in the early 2000s. Governor Bill Richardson appointed her to the New Mexico Humanities Council. Hey, Dr. Orozco.
Yes. Good morning again.
Good morning. So tell us all about yourself first before we get into this great book, which I can't wait to discuss. So I know you're a historian. We know you're a historian, but tell us a little bit about your background growing up in Texas. How did you come to studying history, and what is the work you're doing now?
As you mentioned, I am a graduate from the University of Texas at Austin. I did attend the University in San Marcos before, but I'm originally from Cuero. My mother graduated from high school in 1938 in Mercedes, Texas. She was originally from Mexico. My dad was also from Mexico. But because my mother had a high school education from the 30s, she was highly educated for her time. When she came to Cuero, she was very cognizant of the racial discrimination against both the Mexican community and the African-American community. Cuero, we actually had one-third of our population in the year 1900 was African-American. It was previously a cotton community with slavery. So we had African-American neighbors and friends, and we had significant racism in our community. We had a segregated Mexican school there up until 1940 for the Mexican descent population. And then, of course, we had a African-American high school that actually went on until around 1969 or so, way after the Brown decision. So she was cognizant of racism and inequality and made sure that we attended the classes that we needed. We all excelled in high school, and I'm proud to say that all six of us went to college. and graduated from college. All of us benefited from the Pell Grant. We also benefited from the rise of the Chicano movement. And so luckily, when I got to the University of Texas at Austin around 1977 or so, there were a few Mexican-American history classes. So I took my very first class, and therefore, for the very first time, I began to learn about our specific community. And I was interested in our history and became a historian, actually conducting research as a young historian as a sophomore. So I did original primary research as a sophomore, junior, and senior. I wrote a senior honors thesis, and that's actually how I got to the topic of my book on Adelas Los Vento. Adelas Los Vento was an elderly woman in the mid-70s. She was about 75 or so when she wrote and published a book about Alonso Perales, the major founder of the LULAC organization. LULAC stands for League of United Latin American Citizens. It's the oldest Latino civil rights organization in the country. And luckily, I was working as a work-study student at the Center for Mexican-American Studies. Her son, Dr. Arnoldo Bento, was a professor of Spanish and Chicano studies, and he is the person who introduced me to his mother. So then I visited her in the valley. She lived both in San Juan and Edinburgh, Texas. And when I visited her in San Juan, she shared materials related to the founding of LULAC. What she did not do is share the really larger extent of her collection. So I didn't know that she herself was a major activist. She did let me know that she was a collaborator and activist along with Alonso Perales and other LULAC leaders, but she never gave herself attention. And so therefore, I didn't expect to write anything about her. And later, when I went to UCLA to study and I tried to interview her, she was already elderly and not interested in talking about herself. So fortunately, what happened is that finally, around 2009, the Alonso Perales papers finally got to an archive, finally got to a professional archive. They got to the University of Houston. And there was a major conference about Perales, who again was the major founder of LULAC, but who had died in 1960. And so from 1960 to 2009, almost 40 years, his papers were in the possession of the family, and therefore historians could not access his papers. So after I looked at some of his papers, I saw more materials from Adelas Los Vento, and that's how I recognized her significance.
So what made you decide to write a book about her? What made you decide to delve into her biography?
Well, then at that point, after I saw some of her materials, I approached her son, Dr. Vento, who by that time was retired and also in his mid-70s. And I suggested to him that maybe the two of us could put a few of her writings together. I was thinking maybe four or five of her writings and just a real brief intro, more like a pamphlet. What I did not know is that she had a more extensive collection. And he told me, he said, well, I have her papers. And I didn't know exactly what that meant. So he invited me over, and then he showed me about, I'd say about five very large three-ring binders of her writings and newspaper clippings. And then I saw that her archive was significant and that her own history was significant. I really could not have seen or known that before. Again, her material were not in any archive, and so there's no way somebody could really have known that she was as important as she turned out to be. So we started to write one book together. It didn't work out, but then we're both now happy that he did write the first book about her, published about 2 years ago, and then mine was also recently published as well. So we actually have two. Now his is distinctive in that it includes many of her original writings. So if people want to read her actual writings, they are going to have to read or purchase his book in order to do that.
So tell us, for the audience who does not know a lot about Adela Sosvento, tell us about her life and why she's so significant to American history, to Texas history, to Mexican American history, to women's history, all those trajectories she passed. Tell us the importance of her life.
Okay, well, I will say on the national level, perhaps the most important thing is that she was the most prolific Mexican-American woman writer on civil rights, definitely before the 1970s. We don't have any evidence of any other woman that wrote more letters to the editors, op-eds, and even a few manuscripts writing on the topic of Mexican-American civil rights. So at the time, that would have meant someone who wrote against racial segregation in the schools and in public facilities, somebody who would have written about unequal and low wages for the Mexican community, particularly in agribusiness, somebody who would have written about the poverty that was in that community at the same time. So at the national level, that's her significance. At the Texas level, again, it's the same case where she is the most prolific and the most vocal on the question of civil rights. Again, we did have the LULAC organization, but folks should know that LULAC, when it was founded in 1929, was segregated by gender. So unlike the example of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, we had this experience of segregation by gender in the LULAC. Originally, women were excluded in 29, finally permitted in 1933, but in separate councils. So in a sense, even within our own community, we were being marginalized according to gender. So in Texas, again, she would have been the most vocal. She did this not in one strong organization, but mostly as an independent person working out of her home through letters and newspapers. So that's her Texas significance. The other thing I should mention is that she spans two social movements. So we have the Mexican-American Civil Rights Movement, which most of us are beginning to date 1920 to the early 60s. And then she also enters into the Chicano movement, which is the 1960s to the late 70s. So again, at the national level, we don't really know of people that span both of those movements, particularly women. So that's another part of her significance. In terms of women's history, again...
Excuse me, before you go into women's history, just for a clarification for our audience, can you clarify the difference between the Mexican-American movement and the Chicano movement, please?
Yes, the Mexican-American Civil Rights Movement, we call it that because it is primarily organized by people who are Mexican-Americans versus Mexican immigrants. Before the LULAC and before the 1920s, most of the organizations that existed were mutual aid societies or labor unions, which did not make a distinction by citizenship. As the 1920s went on and as the Border Patrol and immigration laws began to change, the Border Patrol was created in 1924, citizenship becomes more important. So the conditions that they're fighting are, again, political empowerment, meaning to bring an end either to the poll tax or simply more so just pay the poll tax and exercise an independent vote without white people and without white employers telling people how to vote. It's also about economic uplift, meaning get rid of dual wages or get better wages, promotions, to not have jobs classified by race. It also means get rid of segregated housing because there would have been racial covenants in Texas and elsewhere that stipulated houses could not be bought by Mexicans, so-called Negroes at the time or Indians at the time. So it would have been all those things. And again, for women, the Ladies LULAC did a number of things. Ladies LULAC suggested that women should be active in civic engagement, that women should vote, that women should voice their opinions. And we also know that they played significant roles in fundraising for, and this is actually your own research that, that you have done shows that the women of the American GI Forum in the late 40s on contributed significant monies through tamales and through a queen contest to raise money for the desegregation cases of the late 40s and 50s. The LULAC women do the same thing. They get people to vote. They helped elect Raymond Dias, the first Chicano mayor of El Paso in 1960. They helped to get Henry B. Gonzalez into the Texas legislature and helped other candidates. They helped Gus Garcia become the first Mexican-American school board member in San Antonio in the mid-40s or so. So these are all the things that the Mexican-American Civil Rights Movement is doing. What we see happening in the Chicano movement, which begins in the 1960s, is we see even greater attention to Mexican ethnic pride. So we see greater support for the Spanish language. By that time, we had more we started to have the problem of assimilation, the loss of the Spanish language, the loss of the culture, the lack of knowledge about the history. We also began to support Chicano studies. The farm workers at the national level, especially with Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, Delislaus Vento, supported the farm workers. She also supported the more radical activity of students. She supported the student walkouts that were occurring in Texas. We had that in Ed Couch, ELSA, San Antonio, Kingsville, other places. So we don't have that knowledge of that many elder people who are supporting those a little bit more, they call them radical, but a little bit more progressive activities. So that also makes her unusual.
Thank you for distinguishing between those two movements, because a lot of times people don't understand what is why we distinguish those two movements.
Yes, and also I should say that really we see some parallels. I know that sometimes people talk about Martin Luther King being more moderate compared to Malcolm X or Stokely Carmichael, and it's the same phenomenon. Where LULAC would have been seen similar to the NAACP and King, and the Chicano movement would have been associated in Texas with Jose Angel Gutierrez, who said, you know, we need to kill the gringo. He would have been more so compared to somebody like Malcolm X. But really, it's important, and I think Adelis Los Ventos said that really it's all about the same thing, and even the recent work of Peniel Joseph suggests that, you know what, it's still the same issues. It's really about empowerment. And the language changes, but really it's about empowerment, and she recognized that. She even said, hey, you know, I'm cool with the word Chicano. I really call myself a Mexican-American, but it's still about uplift and empowerment.
Exactly. So go ahead and finish. I just wanted you to distinguish that, but could you go ahead and finish about discuss how she has influenced the women's movement as well?
Yes, I would say that some people have asked, well, was she really a feminist? Because we know she did not fight the gender segregation of LULAC. But I would say yes, because number one, she's side of gender norms almost all of her life, okay? Meaning that number one, she is civically engaged, okay? So she is not just inside of the home. Number two, she promotes the ladies LULAC. That's what the women's groups were called. She calls them women fighters. Also, she writes op-eds and letters to the editor, to the politicians who are 99% male. So she is breaking that gender boundary as well. We do have evidence from her letters that sometimes she felt like her husband nagged her about why was she doing this, or it was costing the family, but she did it anyway. And, you know, she kind of jokes about that. But also, she wrote an important article in the early 30s called Why There Is No Happiness in Many Latino Homes, criticizing the idea that about women's place and that that men were privileged in the home. So also I should say on a personal note that she supported me. She saw me as a young woman who had opportunities because of the women's movement. And she saw possibilities in me that she herself did not have during her time, that I could help as a historian, young historian, that I could help advance our history and tell the history of Alonso Perales, the subject of her book.
So when you look at her life, what do you think is, you know, after studying her papers, being able to, you know, talk with her and be around her, listen to have conversations with people who knew her, such as her son and others, what do you think is the biggest legacy and significance of her life? Or it doesn't necessarily have to be one thing, but what are the many ways you think her legacy
There's as you suggest, there's a number of them. Again, like I said, despite the fact that she is married, despite the fact that she is a woman, despite the fact that she has children, and despite the fact that she also works as a jail matron from the late 40s on for about 20 years, she still manages to have a voice and she still manages to be civically engaged. So this means she's mostly working out of the home, probably in her kitchen or somewhere else in the house where she's writing. So she is successful in becoming a writer. She does have a little bit of what I call gendered ambivalence, not always feeling secure in doing so, but she still continues to do it. Another thing that's quite interesting about her is that she does maintain correspondence with at least three of the major civil rights leaders, especially the pre-World War II leaders, Alonso Perales, who is an attorney, U.S. diplomat, and the major founder of LULAC. She also maintains correspondence with J.T. Canales, who was the only non-white state representative in Texas in the 1910s and 1900s and 1910s, and who had filed charges against the Texas Rangers. And she also has correspondence with J. Lou Sines, who's a teacher in South Texas and other parts. So I have looked at the correspondence of these three male leaders, and she is the only woman who has regular correspondence with them throughout the years. So again, here she's breaking gender norms. So she is quite unusual. Also, I should mention the fact that she's writing letters to the President of the United States. She writes Truman, she writes Eisenhower, she writes LBJ, she writes Carter, Johnson, Kennedy. We should also recognize that even today, only 10% of people in the U.S. tend to write an elected official. So she is so unusual in her time. She also writes presidents of Mexico, particularly about the Bracero program. She is a witness to the super exploitation of Mexican braceros and Mexican farm workers. Really, their living standard is is equal, just about as bad as the post-Reconstruction ex-slaves in the South. That is how bad the exploitation was of the braceros, earning pennies in South Texas for very hard labor in the fields.
This is such a good book. It's called Agents of Change. Adela Schloss Bento, Mexican-American civil rights activist and Texas feminist. And it was written by our guest here, historian Dr. Cynthia E. Orozco. Dr. Orozco, what, as people pick up this book and read about Ms. Schloss Bento's life, what do you want them to get out of your book? Because I know you put a lot of energy, work, passion, and love into this project. What do you want our audience to take away from reading your book?
Well, I want folks to realize that, my God, we had this super duper major activist, feminist, and writer that I wonder, had I not been alive, if we would have discovered her maybe in another 20 or 30 years. So we don't have enough historians. We have significant people out there. You know, she really was kind of like an Ida B. Wells reformer if she had, but she's not a journalist. Again, that's the interesting thing. She's not a journalist, but so she is a woman who seeks to make change. And despite the fact that Texas is highly racially segregated, that there's gender segregation in the Mexican American community, that there is patriarchal and gender suppression by the Democratic Party in Texas, because she's also active as a Democrat and later as a Rasunida person, that she still continues to assert her voice. So despite the suppression of so many decades, she nonetheless continues to speak out. So I think her tenacity is really quite amazing.
Yes, especially when you put it in the context of her time. It's funny that you mentioned Ida B. Wells, because that's who I first thought of as soon as I started reading the first few pages of this book, is how these women of color still assume their power despite the times they lived in, despite the fact that they were mistreated because of their identities and because of their gender, and they still found a way.
Yeah, so they do have agency, but you know, actually the title Agent of Change comes from the fact that she wrote herself that she considered herself an undercover agent, because sometimes she would go hang out amongst the braceros and other immigrant farm workers to see their living conditions. So she felt like she was an undercover agent. And that's where the Agent of Change comes from. That's part of the title of the book.
That's a great, great way to look at it. Like, she's an agent by actually looking at the lives, being able to go undercover, as you say, and look at the conditions of various people's lives and various situations, but also being an agent in terms of her own power, usurping her own power. So it's like a pun, you know, an agent in both ways. Well, thank you so much. Where can our audience go to purchase your book?
Well, it's been published by the University of Texas at Austin, the University of Texas Press. So they can go to that website and locate it there. It's actually also at Walmart, and it's also at Target. So I think very early on, the folks saw that this was going to be a popular book.
Well, I'm really happy delighted to hear that for you. And this book is hot off the press. It was just published this year in 2020. So to my audience, it would be a great Thanksgiving gift, a great Christmas gift, a great gift any time of the year. We hope that you will purchase this. And thank you so much Dr. Orozco, and I must have you back to talk about your other book, No Mexicans, Women or Dogs Allowed, which is also
a reading.
When you have time, please do come back and tell us about your book, because we're all about reading and disseminating knowledge here on the Empowerment Zone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Hi, today we have Dr. Cynthia E. Orozco of Texas, who is our guest in this segment. We are talking about strategies for college success. And Dr. Orozco, as you can see, doctor, she's been successful in college. So I know she has some great advice for you today. Hi, Dr. Orozco.
Hello there. Nice to have you.
So tell me, what schools did you attend? What were your majors? And then give us that one strategy that you would give students for college success.
Yes, I first attended Southwest Texas State University. I actually could not get into UT because my SAT scores were too long. Nonetheless, once I was in college, I found out that I was an excellent writer. And then when I went to UT Austin, I found out that I could also be an excellent writer, an excellent researcher, and an excellent thinker. So if we were to think about some strategies for college success, I would say that once you're in school, make sure that you know how to study. I think many of us were never taught the skills. You know, how do you study for an exam? How do you read a chapter? How do you write an essay? So that would be my first point of advice. Secondly, I would say that try to enter your field if you know what you want to do already. Enter it early. Do not assume that because you are an undergraduate that you are low life and cannot participate in the profession. Too many times the hierarchy gets undergraduates to obey those rules, and they don't enter into their own interests. They don't get into their own research. They're not participating in professional association. So I would say enter the field early. I did so as a sophomore. Thirdly, I would say suggest that students develop close relations with their major professors, find out what their world is about, your particular discipline, and connect with them and get their advice early on. And fourthly and lastly, I would suggest that they also begin to publish, particularly the written word, which lasts for decades and centuries, and also take advantage of the new technologies, take advantage of podcasts, take advantage of visual presentations on the internet, that there are so many ways to get your work and your name and your ideas out there.
I love that advice, Dr. Orozco. We have four pieces of advice. That's
yes.
Dr. Orozco for
and
you.
I have plenty more.
Learn how to study as soon as you get to school, because we know that many times we go through high school and no one has taught us how to study. So learn how to study. Enter your field early. If you know what your interest is, go ahead and enter it. Don't delay learning about your particular
And don't observe from the outside. Get into it.
Yeah, exactly. Get into it. Number three, develop close relationships with your professors. We know the professors are your entree into all types of opportunities. They are great mentors. They can help you accelerate your process in terms of your professional and educational development. So make sure you develop relationships with your professors. And lastly, publish. Publish your thoughts. Publish your research. And it's much different now than when we were in schools. There are all types of places you can publish.
Oh, a zillion places.
Exactly.
And I want to say that actually as early as 1975, when I was a senior in high school, I started to write letters to the editor. So,
that's it.
You know, I have a long history of publications, over 40 years or so of writing. And it doesn't matter if it's a letter to the editor in your school newspaper. And nowadays, so many things end up on the internet. So get things that can end up on the internet, because then it becomes global and it becomes permanent until the end of the earth.
Yes, and your voice is important, and it makes a difference when it's the written word versus you just talking about your
yes.
perspectives.
Yes. Yes, and that's why people have to hone their writing skills, because you want to be a good writer. And you want to be a solid thinker. So again, what college allows us to do is to improve our thinking skills as well, our critical thinking skills.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Roscoe. That was great advice. And I'm sure these students are going to take it and run with it, as well as the parents who are listening who want to give their children and loved ones advice for college.
So the last one, of course, is have fun. College is supposed to be fun. It's
exactly.
not just about work. Have fun. Fun has to be something that we do daily.
Yes, yes. Fun has to be something we do daily. That's a quote for us today, because you know we're workaholics, we're nerds, we love to work, so let's have some fun. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Roscoe.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Houston.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ungully, theme song, NADWORKS, digital support, and of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.